You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2023 on Monocle Radio.
Could NATO members come individually to Ukraine's defence? Russia finds another forum in which to deny everything, and the Japanese firms you can hire to fire you. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Daniela Peled and Vincent McAvaney will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll have Henry Rhys Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Daniela Peled, Managing Editor for the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and by Vincent McAvaney, journalist and regular politics commentator for Monocle Radio. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Daniela, as regular listeners, like the Daily has any other kind, etc., will be aware you are often travelling places, very often it seems specifically to visit their local history museums.
Isn't everyone? Is this not a thing?
It's quite a niche hobby. Whose local history museums have you recently been visiting?
Most recently I've been in Aarhus, Denmark's second city, which I highly recommend as a city break. And I saw very much local Danish history.
What kind of local history do they have in Aarhus?
Rather wonderfully, they have one of those museums, open-air museums, where they transport houses from around the country to one particular place. They're very, very very fond of them in the former Soviet Union and here as well. And I can see your eyes glazing over.
But you somewhat.
I can't even really put into words how glorious it was. And, you know, they even had horse manure in the stables and people.
It's well worth flying all the way
exactly.
to Denmark
it
for
was,
that.
And people making like butter, wine or whatever it is. You just had to be there.
Clearly. Do you have any further such expeditions coming up?
I'm going to Suffolk in a couple of weeks. I shall report back duly.
Okay. To any particular part of it?
A small village which has it actually has a local history museum, but it's only open 2 days a week, so let's see.
Okay, well, we look forward to that very much. Everybody can start hanging up their advent calendars now. Vincent, you have been to Edinburgh, as I understand it.
Yes, that's right. I took a trip north of the border to Scotland for a lovely weekend in Edinburgh, which, if I didn't live in London, is probably the only other place in the UK I'd quite like to live. It's a fantastic city.
It is. I don't know if I could hack the winters, but I do like Edinburgh.
That is true. The winters are pretty grey and it gets dark so early.
But in the summer, 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. But it's great in the summer. It's, you know, got the festival as well throughout the summer months, the biggest arts cultural festival in the world. And I was there to see Beyonce fill a stadium in the pouring rain and absolutely nail it. It was brilliant.
Well, you've kind of given away the ending here. There has been a fair bit of Beyonce discourse on the Daily these last couple of weeks as various guests have reported back, and I get the impression that I will not be hearing a dissenting view from you.
I don't think you will. I think I've actually seen her twice before, and the last time I saw her was when she was doing Lemonade, so it was quite like a difficult album. It was about the Jay-Z alleged affair, and she was amazing, but it was very robot. She barely talked. This was like completely engaged from the get-go, clearly having fun, living her best post-pandemic life. It was an amazing celebration of queer culture, the sort of black New York balls, and a real celebration and tribute to her late uncle who was part of that scene and who tragically died of HIV/AIDS. So it was just an amazing celebration. I'm a massive concert fan. It's one of the things I missed most in those horrible pandemic years. And it's just nice to get back in the stadium and all sing songs, you know, together.
Well, if listeners will now imagine an anguished grinding of gears, we will start with Ukraine. In the 15 months and change since Russia launched its full-scale invasion, the red line delineating what assistance Ukraine's allies are and are not willing to provide has inched steadily forwards. Long-range missiles, tanks, modern-ish fighter planes. It is still commonly understood, however, that no actual troops from NATO nations will be deployed in Ukraine's defence. Or is it? Former NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, also former Prime Minister of Denmark, has suggested that unless the looming NATO summit in Vilnius furnishes tangible security guarantees for Ukraine, some sympathetic nations may saddle up unilaterally. Daniela, does this sound plausible? That would be quite the step.
I think it's a plausible diplomatic move. It's a plausible thing to say. I mean, as we sit here, the much vaunted counteroffensive apparently is beginning in Ukraine. And it's not just a military offensive, it's also a diplomatic one. It's also about ensuring that Western countries continue to support Ukraine. And the looming NATO summit seems another opportunity for member states to go, not quite. No, you're not there yet. And Ukraine wants a much more resounding show of support. And I think we've gone a little bit too far down the line for people to be saying, look, we don't want to provoke Russia. Russia has been provoked. We've gone past that. Whether member states such as Poland, who has great reason to be extremely leery of Russian actions, would go as far as doing that, I think that's numerous steps down the line. But I think it makes a lot of sense for this prospect to be raised ahead of the summit.
Does the prospect, Vincent, sound perhaps a bit, World War III-y?
Well, I think it's about how Russia would interpret it, because if any country that was a member of NATO did sort of deploy Poland over the border into Ukraine, I think Russia would then just sort of claim, we're at full-scale war with NATO, this is what we said was happening all along. I mean, they are effectively already claiming that at the moment, so there's a question of what is the difference here. I think it is interesting. I mean, it's good to have it out there as an option so that it focuses minds at this upcoming NATO meeting. Whether or not, I mean, if you sort of engage like this, particularly with a country like Poland, given its geography, would it be opening itself up to then, you could foresee a situation where Russia decides to send missiles Poland's way and then they've attacked a NATO member on its own soil. And then what happens with the rest of NATO? Do we all have to get drawn in? You could see how very quickly it could escalate. But the one thing we know about how badly this war is going for Putin and how long it's taking is it is causing destabilization in Moscow. We're seeing these open fights between the Wagner Group leadership and Putin. And so anything that sort of keeps going and keeps, as you say, the diplomatic support there going does seem to be ratcheting up tension back at home for Vladimir Putin.
Daniela, you mentioned earlier that there has been, and it's a fairly well-observed phenomenon by now, that we have become, and by we I mean the wider West, Ukraine's allies, increasingly heedless of what Russia might regard as a step too far. And the thing overhanging these considerations is, of course, Russia's nuclear weapons. Do you think we have entirely stopped caring what Russia thinks? And if so, is that wise necessarily?
I don't think we have, but the progress of the war in Ukraine and the level to which Russian troops are willing and able and prepared to go, I think has impressed on the international community and Ukraine's allies that it's too late to worry too much about provoking Russia. And I think this prospect being raised is long, long way from troops on the ground. It's more of a gesture if you don't actually give more firm security guarantees, i.e. an invitation to join NATO, this is what might happen. But I think we've done actually better than one might have anticipated at the start of the invasion. The initial international response was pretty solid, and we've made it through a winter of extremely harsh energy price rises and, the world being impacted by this war in all kinds of ways. But the prospect that lies ahead is really the idea that populations will start supporting more the idea of a negotiated ceasefire. But that could mean all kinds of things. We're not This isn't a war that could be decisively won really by military means. As much as Ukraine says, no, the war will be over when we regain all territory occupied by Russia, that prospect isn't very likely. So I think Ukraine and supporters of Ukraine are trying to make it clear that there is more to be won. There is more ground to be gained, literally. And we haven't reached the end of the military line.
Just a final thought on this one, Vincent. The Vilnius NATO summit is coming up, and advance plug, Monocle's The Foreign Desk will be attending. Clearly, there is a statement being made by holding it in Vilnius, of all places. This is right on NATO's front line. So there will be an amount of pressure, surely, for the summit to make some kind of grandiloquent statement announcement. I'm sure they hope that that will be that Turkey and Hungary have stopped being difficult about Sweden joining NATO. But does there need to be some sort of tangible advance in the support already given to Ukraine?
Well, the question still remaining is, are they going to be given fighter jets? That is still the one thing that, everything that President Zelensky has asked for over the past 18 months, it's initially been, no, can't give them that. 2 months later, they get that the situation is justified. I think, if anything, that is really all that's left for Ukraine. If you did give them F-16s, which various countries, I think Denmark at the moment is doing training of pilots to take over some jets, which they might feel they can give away. The UK as well, the position is unclear whether or not there's some older jets that we could give them too. I think that would be the strongest signal they could sort of send from that meeting. But whether or not, as you say, I think most people now have just kind of ignored when it comes to Russia claiming anything would be a provocation. My mind drifted back, to the fact that in the past 15 years, they've twice used chemical weapons on this country. They, with Alexander Litvinenko, they used polonium, radioactive isotope that polluted parts of London. I spent many a week and reported on it for Monocle down in Salisbury for the chemical, weapons grade chemical weapons that were used there that sadly killed an innocent British person. Well, Russia doesn't seem to have a problem with provoking everyone else and then getting off without any real consequences. So I think that is going to start to be, as you say, just ignored by the rest of the world.
Well, sticking with the subject of Russia and consequences, the indictment in March of President Vladimir Putin by the International Criminal Court, significant though it was, is merely one line item on an extensive rap sheet assembled by Russia since it set about attempting to reassemble the Soviet Union a decade and a half ago. Hearings have begun at the International Court of Justice into a case brought against Russia by Ukraine pertaining to what now seems like phase one of Russia's invasion of Ukraine back in 2014. Ukraine seeks reparations for the initial assault on eastern Ukraine and for the downing over Ukrainian territory of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, hit by a missile fired by Russian proxies, killing all 298 people aboard. Vincent, rather hilariously, Russia is trying to get this case thrown out by making quite narrow appeals to minutiae of law. Why would anybody listen to Russia making appeals to law at this point? I mean, I do have due respect for due process for sure, but surely the judges should just be pointing and laughing.
I mean, I'm sure in their minds they would love to do that. But part of the distinguishing of, international order and in the world of international law with, judicial despot countries like Russia is that you have to show that there is a process, that it is exhausted, and that they have listened to all arguments made and then assessed them fairly or not.
But and then you can point and laugh.
Then you can point and laugh. All it does is make Russia more of a kind of laughing stock internationally. The fact that the evidence on this is so clear cut, and they're looking so petty and trying to get it thrown out on these sort of tiny technical grounds.
Daniela, is it important to pursue justice in a case like this, even when there's frankly unlikely to be any? We have already seen similar cases brought. Three men were convicted last November for 298 murders over the downing of MH17, sentenced to life in prison, fined 16 million euros. Unless something remarkable happens, I think Russia is pretty unlikely to extradite them, just as Russia is probably pretty unlikely to volunteer to pay Ukraine any reparations while it is still in the process of smashing up even more of Ukraine. Nevertheless, is this still worth doing?
Well, Well, very unlikely things happen, certainly
indeed,
do in the fields of international justice. I think the way that Ukraine has been fighting this war on a legal battlefield as well is absolutely fascinating, it both internationally and domestically. There are there's thousands and thousands of investigations, war crimes investigations ongoing, and there's been hundreds of cases brought to court, and there have been numerous convictions, a lot of them in absentia, mm-hmm, of soldiers and officers. And again, you could argue, but what's the point of a conviction in absentia? And some of the people who've been the prisoners of war who've been convicted have been immediately exchanged. But I think there's a very, very strong argument to make that law needs to be done, needs to be seen to be done. It's extremely helpful for the victims, I think. And it's extremely important for the architecture of international security to see consequences for this. And it also is very important for the reparations, which certainly Russia won't volunteer to provide. But this is not any less a concern alongside the ongoing justice processes. The issue with the ICJ, though, is that it's kind of more of a forum for people to sort of argue and sort of thumb their noses at each other. I mean, the decisions are legal, but they've got no enforcement. You can think of many other examples of the 2004 decision that the Israeli security barrier was illegal, made absolutely no difference. Right now, Armenia and Azerbaijan are battling it out there, both accusing the other of basically bad things. And so it's a forum for discussion and point scoring, really, rather than an area where there's going to be substantial difference made. It's not the ICC. The ICC has a chance of serious convictions of serious people.
This does prompt discussion, Vincent, which there will be more of, I can reveal, on tomorrow's Daily, of this idea of hopping into Russia for reparations for what the damage it has done in Ukraine. There is this idea at large that Russia's assets, which have been frozen overseas, might be seized by some mechanism or other and used to help rebuild Ukraine. Does that seem entirely fair?
I mean, I think so. This is very clearly, you know, a war of aggression. It was started by Russia. It was a land invasion. There is, you know, umpteen evidence of that.
But the argument against, and I'm just making the argument, I'm not sure what I think about this entirely, is that those assets do not belong to the Russian regime, but to the Russian people.
Well, there is the argument that, I mean, if we're talking about things like what the sort of super yachts and those kind of
those are privately held assets.
Well, so Russian state assets is what you're saying. I mean, they do belong to the Russian people, but who is actually in control of them at the moment? Is it Vladimir Putin and those around him? Should it be a way of giving a wake-up call to the people of Russia that unless they try and change their own form of democracy and take themselves away from the system that they have set up since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that there isn't much sort of, you know, room or tolerance for them in the world? It is tricky. And just to go back to the point that you were saying about, you know, justice for those involved and the reparations and stuff. You don't have to be in the court yourself to actually feel the weight of justice. The fact that the people involved will, you know, forever have their life altered and changed in what they can and can't do will have a long-term effect and does build pressure as well.
Daniela, we talked a bit before about how unlikely, though it often seems, justice can end up being done in these cases. It may be possible that some imaginable future Russian regime would, for example, extradite the people convicted of bringing down MH17. But if there is a notional, obviously at this point, highly theoretical and more amenable and reasonable post-Putin regime in Russia, should they still be on the hook for this? I mean, it's making only the most obvious point about European history that there's at least one celebrated instance of trying to make a defeated power pay for a war it started with unpleasant consequences a few decades down the track.
I think we've learned lessons. I mean, I think the lessons learnt from the experience of the First World War where the Marshall Plan after the Second World War kind of changed the perspective a bit. That is, I think that's, you know, if we were talking about nation states and treating a nation state as a legitimate entity, then clearly the post-regime government will have to be liable for this as well. And this will be part of any kind of peace deal or post-conflict setup. It's extremely advanced as well. We're looking at all kinds of mechanisms and indeed frozen assets and also of private Russian individuals being held as part of this, the reparations, because reparations won't only be on a state level, they'll also be on a personal and a private level. I mean, the mechanisms ongoing are so enormous that certainly reparations are and will play a key part from the national level to the individual.
Well, let's move along somewhat. And in many countries, in Europe in particular, public display of the flag of Nazi Germany is likely to occasion a visit from the police, assuming no public-spirited citizen chops down your flagpole first. Australia is one such country, with many of its constituent states having already passed or proposed laws against the flaunting of Nazi symbols. But now the federal government has got involved, seeking a national ban of the swastika and associated iconography such as the double lightning bolt logo of the SS. Authorities have cited an upsurge in far-right activity embodied by a couple of recent demonstrations by a few dozen tedious weirdos in Melbourne. Vincent, this is by definition a symbolic gesture, but nevertheless, is it an important one?
Well, you know, you think about, as you say, in lots of places in Europe, there is legislation like this, particularly Holocaust denial legislation, that is basically a crime. And it's been something that they've had to sort of redouble down on in recent years, particularly when it comes to social media companies and the way they operate in certain countries in Europe. It is symbolic. It is important. There is sadly a rise in this stuff. If you do look at very accessible social media, not even, you know, going off to places like the dark web or wherever, if you look into the depths of Twitter and Facebook, there is a rise in sort of Nazism and neo-Nazism. There is a couple of cases in the UK of sort of far-right groups who clearly identify with this iconography. They sort of go off on these sad, lame training camps, and there's footage of them sort of with these symbols proudly on display. And it is just always important to stop the slow creep of it in any way being seen as acceptable for people who are really at the fringes of society, who just get sort of sucked into these vortexes from social media, to just very clearly say this stuff is not acceptable for a reason.
Daniela, I think Vincent makes a very, very good point that where you do see most of this stuff these days, it is on social media, where it is circulated, strangely enough, by largely anonymous accounts. There is not much of it, I am very pleased to be able to report, seen in public in Australia. Is a law like this important? Does it change anybody's mind? And is it more effective than perhaps, I can see that this would be a somewhat irresponsible attitude for authorities to take, to say to somebody proposing to wear a swastika armband and walk down the main street in Melbourne or Sydney, well, give it a try and see how it goes for you.
And
by the way, you don't get to call us when the inevitable occurs.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, it sends an important signal, I agree. But then I think there are much larger issues of freedom of speech here. You know, just to make clear, I'm not a fan of Nazis in any way or swastikas. But I think in sort of functioning democracies, it's much better to let society self-regulate itself. As you said, if you were to walk down a street in Melbourne dressed in full Nazi regalia, it wouldn't end well.
It would be a short walk.
Exactly, exactly. So I think it's important to, you know, make incitement to violence or racial hatred illegal. That's also something that's more prosecutable, really, than just displaying a symbol.
Is there not the argument that displaying this particular symbol is, by definition, incitement to racial hatred, though?
There's an equal argument to say that it's expressing an odious opinion and so on. I think in the long run and in the wider sense, it's more important for society to be having those conversations. But again, if you've made it illegal, how are you going to prosecute this? And what is the benefit of actually prosecuting it? Is the benefit just sending a signal? Well, that's something, but isn't that also just performative? Unless I cannot see the reason for Germany, for instance, to have a law criminalising Holocaust denial, I can't see the benefit in a context like the United Kingdom, for instance. And I think this is sort of served to make everyone talk about Nazi symbols, really.
Well, a related question, Vincent, is there a danger that going to all the trouble of passing laws, etc., makes a very small coterie of boring dingbats seem more dangerous than they actually are?
Yeah, that is the potential of this. It's just such a weird world when you sort of, you know, you see these people that are so ring-fenced in their social media, that get so pulled in to it, that sometimes they do need these loud signals to kind of wake them up and say that, you know, offline, this stuff is completely not accepted by society. But, I mean,
do you think that maybe an exemplary fire hosing might wake them up?
Yeah, you know, perhaps, you know, you look back at what Charlie Chaplin did, and he just, with his famous movie The Dictator, and he just decided the best way to make this look as ridiculous and as terrible as this is to laugh at them, is to make fun of them, is to mock them. And, you know, these people, as you say, if they were to walk down a street in Melbourne, if they think that they walk down a high street in London, they wouldn't last very long before someone was pulling it off them and destroying the symbol for them anyway.
Well, to Japan now, where an enterprising startup has found a way to market a new means of leaving one's place of employment for those dissatisfied with the traditional options of politely but regretfully explaining yourself and working your notice, or flouncing with a defiant cry of, to quote David Alan Coe's phrase made famous by the 1977 Johnny Paycheck hit, take this job and shove it. A company called Exit will, for a consideration, quit on your behalf. For 20,000 yen, it's about 134 euros, Exit will spare you the awkwardness. Exit launched in 2017, but their service has proved popular enough to lately inspire several competitors, which in itself must generate still more business as they poach executives from each other. Daniela, would you ever avail yourself of such a service? Were you minded to leave your current position? Would you turn up and say, I am leaving my current position? Or would you pay someone else 134 euros to do it for you?
I mean, perhaps not professionally, but personally, it would be might be quite a useful service if you can avail yourself of it. I think this speaks rather directly to Japanese culture and society, perhaps a bit less indirect, a bit more indirect, and perhaps value workplace.
And that's a British person calling someone else indirect.
Exactly, exactly. Also exemplified. Also exemplified. No, I don't think. I don't think I ever have, or well, never say never.
Vincent, what about you? Do you see this 134 euros well spent to not to have to tell your current employers I don't want to work here anymore?
No, I've loved doing that multiple times. I've really enjoyed that moment. Either because, you know, if it's an offer's come in that I think is a good opportunity, but I've had a boss that I respect and liked, I've always been direct with them and said, look, this has come in. I didn't seek it, but the offer's been made. Would you be willing to counteroffer and doing it that way? And, you know, it was all amicable. But I can think of two jobs where I didn't like the boss, where the culture had been quite toxic. And I very much enjoyed typing out that email using subtle FU phrases, to be honest.
That's the passive aggressive euphemism laden British resignation, isn't it?
Definitely. There is a massive cultural difference. I mean, I can think of only one person in my life. I've been out of university 15 years. I can think of only one person who still works for the same company. Lots of people change so much more often these days. And I'm not just talking about journalists. This is sort of across industries I know of. But it was interesting in this copy that, you know, in Japan, it's still that country, OECD country, where people stay in professions, in positions for the longest period. That is a massive cultural difference that they have. But I think in the UK, you're pretty used now to signing up and moving on to other jobs.
Is there an argument, Daniela, that this means employing an intermediary means that everybody at both ends gets more honest feedback? You don't have to do the with great regret, I must leave. Well, we're terribly sorry to see you go. It's understood at both ends that this particular company is an absolute toxic bin fire and or that this employee is a total idiot.
I don't think there's anything. I don't think the idea of useful feedback in work situations is a real thing. Yeah,
as there is no useful feedback.
There is no useful feedback. I mean, there are useful euphemisms. As somebody who has done many employee reviews and had to review many employment. No, it's all about the useful euphemism.
I would actually pay. I've just thought of the situation. I would pay this company in the UK if they could guarantee that you got gardening leave every time. That would be the only thing worth paying for. That would be quite an outfit if they could get you that.
I've never had gardening leave. I'm quite jealous.
Neither have I.
No,
no. You and I both, I've got friends that, were furloughed in the pandemic, and they talk about it, as their, panny gap year or whatever. And you and I worked all through that time, so I feel like I missed out on a little career break in that period. Gardening leave would be pretty great.
So neither of you have ever flounced dramatically, never done the full blown take this job and shove it.
I've been flounced.
I've been flounced
out of jobs.
As in, like you've been flung down the stairs with your possessions in a cardboard box following you, boot print in seat of trousers, etc.
Definitely. Lots to define a point on it. Yep. I think I may be legally forbidden for going into details, but yeah, much flouncing was done.
Vincent, have you ever flounced as such?
Not like a full straight out, I'm out of here sort of thing, but I did sort of make it very well known to one person that they were a huge factor in the decision to go, the person that I was resigning to, and she made some comments and I made some comments back. More, and I don't regret them.
More huge understatement.
Honestly, it's amazing in this country anybody ever gets fired. Vincent McAvaney and Daniela Peled, with that, we are letting you both go, I'm afraid. Finally on today's show, time for Henry Rhys Sheridan's latest letter from New York City.
$690 million. That's how much New York's Metropolitan Transport Authority lost last year to fare evasion. The MTA controls public transport in New York. All public transport systems have to deal with fare dodging, and there's been plenty of global experimentation in different ways to address it. But it's a tricky problem to solve, because it's really difficult to identify factors that predictably influence rates of fare evasion. For example, I think many people would assume that an effective physical barrier system would be one of the most straightforward ways of addressing fare dodging. I did, anyway. But the evidence suggests they're basically arbitrary. Berlin's public transport uses an honesty system. There are no barriers to entry at subway stations. Riders are trusted to purchase and validate tickets themselves before riding. There are unannounced in-vehicle inspections, but the fines for fare dodging are fairly low. In contrast, every subway station in London is guarded by ticket barriers, and there are relatively high fines for being caught without a ticket.
Ticket, please. Try your pocket. These are not tickets.
But despite these different approaches, historically, the two systems have had relatively similar rates of fare evasion, between 3 and 6%. There are other examples of physical barriers making little difference to rates of fare evasion. Oslo saw evasion rates remain steady when it removed physical barriers on public transport, and San Francisco says it saw a decrease in evasion when it removed barriers in the 1990s. That physical barriers don't seem to matter is just one piece of the complex public transport fare evasion puzzle. But New York is in a rush to figure out as many pieces as possible as fast as it can. Last month, the Metropolitan Transport Authority estimated the fare evasion rate on the New York City subway to be a staggering 16%. Since Eric Adams became mayor on January 1st, 2022, the attempts to address subway fare evasion have been somewhat clumsy. There was a spike in subway crime during the pandemic. In response, Adams sent hundreds of police officers into the subway system, officers who were also tasked with catching turnstile jumpers. But armed police officers stopping people for dodging a $2.75 fare was regarded as heavy-handed, and a disproportionate number of those stopped were black and brown New Yorkers, which did nothing for the already fraught relationship between police and civilians. Also, as the 2022 fare evasion rates reveal, the approach simply didn't work. The new fare evasion report sets forward new solutions to reduce fare dodging. One is introducing more fare checkers and better fare checking technology on buses where there are no barriers and where there's even more fare dodging than on the subway. Another is to expand a program that reduces fares for low-income New Yorkers. The hope is that this would reduce the number of people dodging fares for economic reasons. Currently, the program is only eligible to people who fall below the federal poverty line of about $28,000 a year. The figure changes depending on how many people are in a household. The problem is that the program is short of funding. The MTA also hasn't given up on barriers. They want to introduce modern sliding glass ones to replace the metal turnstiles that currently predominate on the subway. The fare dodging report explicitly says that modernising physical barriers is the single most important thing the MTA can do to reduce fare evasion in the subway.
Cedric swipes and heads to the train. The MTA installed the new pilot project in the past few days at Atlantic Avenue Barclays by the new customer service center.
I hope it continues and I want it to stay. They need more of these around the city.
Whatever is done, the MTA needs to find funds fast by recouping lost fare money and by any other means. One potential source of income is a share of future revenues from casinos that the state is planning to open. As to whether the new barriers will help, as we've seen from other cities, all bets are off.
Henry Ree Sheridan in New York City. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Daniela Pellid and Vincent McAvenny. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Helmi Pillai. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.